And away we go, taking you home into Monday. You've got one down, four to go with this work week already. This is the Sports Rush, your daily local sports fix, 4 to 6. I am Brett Rump, Caleb Hatch in the producer's chair. Big hour ahead. We're going to be talking to Brian Esposito, TinCast manager. He'll join us at 5:20. Also, Kevin Bowen from 107.5 The Fan down in Indianapolis, the morning show host, co-host, along with Jake Query. Kevin will be along at 5:35. So our Parkview Sports Medicine text line for you to connect with the show is 46862, 46862. Hey, don't forget, you can win tickets to the Indy 500. All you have to do is text 500, the number 500, to 46862, or you can go online to 1380thefan.com to get information on how you can register to win a pair of tickets to Sunday's race. Trace Jackson Davis coming back to Indiana. And you also have Nick Foles coming back to join Frank Reich. A couple of big, I guess you call them homecomings, even though it's not a true homecoming for Nick Foles. He is being partnered with a coach that he's had his greatest career success with in Frank Reich, when Frank Reich was the offensive coordinator of the Philadelphia Eagles. And together, they collected Super Bowl rings. But I don't think this is a surprise. Caleb, we've talked about this since about the time the season ended, that the Colts needed to kind of stabilize that backup quarterback position. And even when we thought they might have Wentz, we still said Nick Foles wouldn't be a bad idea. Now you've seen Wentz and the failure that Wentz has been, a guy that also has a relationship with Frank Reich. Do you feel different about the Colts signing Nick Foles, or is this a good deal?
I mean, we don't know the dollar figure, right? I haven't seen that anywhere, but a 2-year deal, so that's some stability. Goes in line with Matt Ryan. I think this is a great move for a backup quarterback. Obviously, maybe not a great move if he's going to be your starting quarterback, but in a pinch, if something happens with Matt Ryan, he has to miss some time. Solid backup quarterback. Add some depth to the position. Familiar with Frank Reich's offensive system. I mean, these are all a lot of positives. A good fit. Hopefully, he's a good fit in the locker room as well. And we'll see what happens. Hopefully, though, you don't have to use him, right? Except in a blowout situation.
Yeah, that's the point of having a backup, is that you'll never need him, but he's the insurance policy. But I think the one thing it does tell us is that the Colts believe it is win now, that they have the opportunity to win now. It's no longer about the future. It's no longer about the young talent. It is about a chance to win today, and they don't want to screw it up by having an injury to Matt Ryan, and they want to have a better backup than Sam Ellinger. And so they went out. I mean, they spent some kind of money they wouldn't have normally spent if they were happy with Sam Ellinger. And they probably had to guarantee the money to Nick Foles to get him on that 2-year deal. But as far as I'm concerned, if it's, you know, that $5 million, $6 million range, I don't know. I don't know the going rate for a backup exactly. But I would think that with the Colts cap situation, if they were spending 10 or more, they're overpaying. If they're spending less than five, Nick Foles is kind of getting taken to the cleaners a bit. So I would say it's in that 5, 6, 7 range, but I think that's fair for both sides. Colts needed a veteran backup. If they think it is win now, then they had to have somebody better than Sam Ellinger. So I'm good with it. But IU also, with Trace Jackson Davis coming back, I know this has Hoosiers fans really hyped up, that they're getting TJD. Now, I don't know what kind of a player they're going to get back. Are they going to get the player that played a big post game last year and have a guy that's more dominant at the post? Or are they going to get a guy that's outside in the perimeter setting three-point arc ball screens and playing that pick-and-pop game? I don't know what kind of game they're going to get from Trace Jackson Davis, but definitely, it's a plus to have a talented player that returns to your program. You've got stability. You've got good incoming freshmen. And now you can choose if they play, if they earn the job. It's not like you're building a program and you're going to accept the freshman mistakes. They go out and make mistakes. You probably have a player that's playing better than them that's going to take those minutes. So, I mean, I like the position the Hoosiers are in. I don't know that I would project them as a national championship contender, but for purposes of our topic, Caleb, what if the Hoosiers, with Trace Jackson Davis's return, found magic in a bottle and got another banner? And I start to think Trace Jackson Davis would all of a sudden kind of go down in Indiana basketball lore as probably one of the greats at Indiana.
Absolutely. I don't think it'd be a doubt. I mean, he'd be on the list with your Scott Mays, your Steve Alfords, your Isaiah Thomases, your Calvert Chaneys. I mean, he'd be on the short list, probably in the top, what?
That's my question. Yeah, Our topic is top
20 for sure.
Who's the number? Like, I had the list and you kind of gave some of them.
Yeah.
Steve Alford, Calvert Chaney, Isaiah Thomas, Kent Benson, Scott May, Quinn Buckner, Damon Bailey, Landon Turner. Not everybody won a national championship, but a lot of them did. Victor Oladipo, Cody Zeller, Ray Tolbert. Am I missing anyone? Does Yogi belong on an all-time list?
Yeah, he's an all-time IU player. I mean, you can definitely include him on there.
Where's the list start? Number one all-time Indiana University basketball player. Where does it start?
I'd say Calvert Chaney.
Does it start with Chaney? Does it start with Thomas? For those that are older, does it start with Benson, May, or Buckner? I mean, remember, Benson, May, and Buckner all played for the last NCAA basketball team to go through a season tournament postseason championship undefeated. And that's been a long time ago. We're coming up on 50 years that it has not been duplicated. Steve Alford. Damon Bailey may have been the biggest high school star, especially if you just talk about guys from Indiana that went to Indiana. But yet, I don't think I'd put him in a top three or four among all-time Indiana players. But if I had to start the list, man, Calvert Chaney's a good start. Isaiah Thomas.
If you're doing top 20, I mean, do guys like Eric Gordon, White, do they sneak up on there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going that deep. I'm just looking for, okay, where does TJD rank? And I guess that's how far I would take the list. Do you rank TJD below an Eric Gordon?
As of right now, yeah. But if they accomplish a lot more this upcoming season, you change the narrative.
Exactly. And that's what I'm saying. Hypothetically, if they win the national title, where does he go down in Indiana history? In other words, how big would it be for him to come back this year if they win a title and are successful for his legacy with Indiana University basketball? He moves from maybe barely in a top 20, if that, to being maybe a top 5 or 6 player in one season.
Yeah, and he's already probably flirting with, you know, you could say top 30. He could be flirting with the top 20 just from what he accomplishes this season, you know, statistically. But if they have postseason success, win a Big Ten title, advance far in the tournament, you know, say get to a Final Four, win a championship, I mean, that would move him way up on the list.
Now, there's a lot of this is only the last 50 years. I had to cut it off because we could start going back into the 50s and the 60s and start adding a whole bunch of new names.
But the Slick reality, Leonard's on that list, if you go back.
But the reality, Caleb, is that none of our listeners personally have experience watching most of the guys that came about before Bob Knight was the coach. And so I thought, okay, we're just going to talk 50 years because 50 years ago was when Bob Knight got hired as the Indiana basketball coach. So, because I think it was 72, if I'm not mistaken. But if you go back 50 years, that's the list. Who's the number one player in the last 50 years in Indiana basketball? You say Chaney.
Chaney or Scott May. That's who I would say.
Yeah, I'm still thinking. Steve Alford may have been the most focused on player. Of course, Damon Bailey got a lot of focus too, but I think Alford, because of the being from Newcastle, being, it seemed like of this list, he may have been the most coached. To this day, I think more people might know Steve Alford nationally. Now, Indiana fans, they would be able to rank them, but nationally, you might have more people that know Steve Alford than know Calvert Chaney. Certainly, I don't think most people remember the names of the 75, 76 Hoosiers with Kent Benson, Scott May, Quinn Buckner, because he's been around the NBA. Landon Turner played on a national championship team. Yeah, I can't argue with your Calbert Cheney. But Scott May was a heck of a player. And if you remember, Scott May got hurt the year before, and that may have cost Indiana back-to-back undefeated national championship seasons.
Correct.
You know who I forgot to put on the list? Because I started typing the list, and the first name I thought of was Mike Woodson, but I didn't put Woodson. So
he's on the short list, but I think at the top, someone texted, Calbert Cheney's the all-time Big Ten scoring leader. It's him. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of why I went with him, or you could argue Scott May, because Scott May was kind of the leader of those great teams in the mid-70s, including the undefeated team.
Yeah. Quinn Buckner was the quarterback, the point guard. Scott May was the top scorer. And Kent Benson, the big down low.
And the number one NBA draft pick.
Yeah, 4'6", 8'6", 2". And a heck of a guy. I've had a chance to sit in the conference room right here in this building and have a chat with Kent Benson. And very, very strong Christian man. That came through very clearly. A very passionate guy about giving back and about doing things for basketball in Indiana. Really good guy. Still resides down in the Newcastle area. 4'6", 8'6", 2", Parkview Sports Medicine text line, 4'6", 8'6", 2". Of course, over the weekend, we had time trials down in Indianapolis, and it's Scott Dixon who has the pole. Colton Herta is the number two. Colton Herta, here's the thing. Let's kind of get this. I guess I should do a better job of setting this up, because this, it's two different subjects. There's the qualifying, and then there's the favorites. And they don't go side by side. And that was the thing I was shocked by. I pulled from my FanDuel account, I pulled all of the favorites and what the odds were for the Indianapolis 500 as of about 3 o'clock today. And Scott Dixon is the favorite. No surprise. Pole sitter.
No. He should be the favorite.
Yeah. And so that's no surprise. He is at 6.5 to 1. 8.5 to 1. Two drivers. And this surprised me. Alex Palou, Colton Herta. And Colton Herta, by the way, qualified in row 9. And yet he is 8.5 to 1 to win the race.
That was one that was, he was, I think, the favorite or co-favorite going into qualifying. They need to adjust that number, but I think a lot of people will just put money on him because he won the Indy GP. He's kind of the young phenom in the series. People in racing kind of know the name because he could go to F1 potentially in a couple years.
There might have been a lot of advance money on him before qualifying.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's keep going down the list. Scott McLaughlin, 10 to 1.
Qualified poorly, otherwise it'd be, you know, more of an option.
Joseph Newgarden is 10 to 1.
That's actually a good value considering, I mean, yeah, he qualified 14th, but he is one of the best drivers in the series. You would think he'd win this race eventually, but it's getting to a point where it's been a long time and he still hasn't won.
In the series, he's pretty consistently a competitor.
Yeah. I mean, and he's competed in this race, but it's kind of been few and far between.
Pato O'Ward, 12 to 1.
Good option there.
Will Power, 13 to 1.
Great option.
Renus VK, 15 to 1.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, I'd feel more comfortable if he was at 20 to 1.
Castroneves, last year I got 42 to 1. Bet $40. You can do the math. I cashed in. He is 19 to 1.
Yeah, I mean,
starting
with where he's starting, you know, if his name's not Elio Castroneves, I mean, you're looking at a guy who's probably, you know, 30, 40, 50 to 1.
Alexander Rossi is 20 to 1. Takuma Sato is 22 to 1. And Tony Kanaan is 24 to 1.
Sato at 22 to 1 is fascinating to me.
I will tell you, in that group I just gave you, I've got two bets.
Sato and Kanaan?
Sato and Kanaan. I feel like Kanaan knows the clock's ticking.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably his last shot with a top-tier team in Ganassi. If he wants to come back and put a deal together, it's going to be with a much smaller organization. So this is his last quality ride. It's the only race he's set to do this year as well. So this could be it.
Second row qualification. I mean, he's outside second row, so he's in a good position to start the race. At 24-1, I thought the number was good. Sato, 22-1, I thought that was a good number. So I went both of those guys. Because I told you I already got a couple bets placed. So you don't feel bad about either one of those at those odds.
No. I think Kanaan will be competitive, but I think Sato's a guy who I would not be surprised at all to see leading some laps and charging forward.
All right, so continuing on, Marcus Ericsson is 25-1.
He is one of the most consistent finishers in the series. He races pretty clean. He's a guy who can string together a lot of top tens. He's won a couple races, won last year, but has not won on an oval. So we'll see how that plays into it.
Graham Rahal's 26-1. Rosenquist.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't touch either of them.
Pagenaud is 28-1.
That is the value pick.
Is it?
Yes. That is absolutely the value. You said 28-1.
Caleb calling the shot. 28-1 on Pagenaud.
Okay. So Simon Pagenaud, he finished third last year. He's an Indy 500 winner. He had a really solid Indy GP after kind of getting his feet wet and figuring things out on a new team with Meyer Shank Racing, teammates with Elio Castroneves this year, both full-time entries in the NTT IndyCar Series. Simon Pagenaud at 28-1 to me is the best value pick I've heard so far.
Okay, because I have one more bet. He was not it, but I think he's going to be added to my list.
Okay.
Ed Carpenter's 29-1.
Again, is he crazy.
Is he worth a shot at 29-1?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. I know that you kind of mentioned he hasn't necessarily finished well, but I think you look at his record in previous years. He finished second in 2018 after winning the pole.
I'm just saying he hasn't won.
Yeah, he hasn't won, but I think the narrative for a few years, go back to last decade, he was a driver who could qualify well, but he couldn't win. But I think he's kind of changed that narrative looking at his finishes in the Indy 500. He was fifth last year, 2020 fell back, but 2019 sixth, 2018 second, 2017 11th. So he's put together better run of finishes. He didn't qualify on pole, which is fine because he's not been all too great outside of 2018 when he's started on pole. So I think to me, that's a great value pick as well.
Just giving you a couple of other names because we don't have time to get everybody, but I'll throw in a couple of the names at you. Connor Daly's 50-1.
Yeah. I mean, he led the most laps last year. He's got speed, didn't show in qualifying, but he has raw speed and he knows how to lead there.
Marco Andretti is 50-1.
You take the name out of it, you wouldn't touch it. I guess that's how I view it.
I kept the name in it, Caleb.
I got
something on Marco.
One other name I want to throw out there. Santino Ferrucci, what are his odds?
He is 70-1.
He's never finished worse than seventh in the Indy 500. I think he has a fourth, a sixth, and then a seventh in his three starts previously as his best qualifying position this year. I get it. It's a one-off team, but they came ready to race. They qualified solidly mid-pack. That's another name I'd throw out there as far as a long shot.
Ferrucci. Okay, so you've got your long shots. Ferrucci, the ones you really like.
Pagenaud, definitely, for sure.
Pagenaud and Ferrucci are two to look at, and Connor Daly, value at 50-1.
Yeah, value. Along with Ed Carpenter, value at 29-1.
46862, Parkview Sports Medicine text line, 46862. Quick timeout. When we return, we talk to TinCast manager Brian Esposito. That's next on The Sports Rush on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. Welcome back to The Sports Rush, your daily local sports fix, 4 to 6. Brett Rump with Caleb Hatch joining us on the Masters Heating and Cooling Hotline. It is Tin Caps manager Brian Esposito. Good afternoon.
How are we doing today?
Doing well. Talking a lot, of course, Indy 500. You managed down in Indianapolis. Did you ever partake in any of the activities? Did you have a chance to take in any of the glamour and the glitz of the Indy 500?
No, you know, I never did. I never made it up to the track. I never got to race a car. And I believe we were always on the road. Every weekend they had the 500, so Ofer the Indy 500.
All right. Well, you know, trying to stall as much as I can before we talk about the past week, because it was a very tough weekend offensively. But let's talk about a couple of the bright spots, because Matthew Acosta joined the roster when Joshua Mears got put on the development list. As far as Mears, I know you hit on it last week about just trying to be more consistent with contact. Is that pitch selection? Is it something that's you know, fundamental mechanically in his swing? What, you know, how long is something like that need to be, I guess, worked on? What's the time frame when a guy goes onto a development list?
You know, I think there's a certain amount of days that once a player is put on development list, he has to stay. I believe it's for 10 days. So he has to stay on the development list for 10 days, and then from there he's able to be activated again onto whatever roster that they see fit to put him on. So, you know, yeah, to your point, you know, contact, the rate of contact, how hard you make contact, all of those things are usually dependent on what you're swinging at. You know, when you start going outside of the zone, or you start to chase, or you start to look in areas where you don't have a high level of slug or damage or rate of hard contact, you know, you start to go in a different direction than you should be. So, yeah, pitch selection definitely lines up with the rate of contact and the rate of how hard you make contact as well.
Is it one of those things that for hitters that it's only natural that they have a different personal time frame in being able to pick up breaking balls and being able to identify strikes? Is it, you know, is it something that just takes longer and has to develop over a longer period of time for some guys?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, that's why, you know, you see 19-year-olds like, you know, Juan Soto in the big leagues doing really big things, and you see some guys get there when they're 25, 24, 26, and then they stay in the big leagues. But then you also see, you know, a lot of players that go up in their first bit of action and get sent back down. You know, there's most of these players in the big leagues that you're seeing on TV right now didn't go up and stay up their first time. I'm assuming guys like Mike Trout went up and went back down. You see guys that Derek Jeter, I heard, went up and never went and came back down. You know, there's guys that don't get it the first time around, you know, and that's also an A-ball. Like, this is a tough league sometimes. You're facing a lot of good college pitchers. There's, you know, there's a bunch of velocity. There's a bunch of guys with some really good off-speed stuff. And, you know, Mears is a young kid coming out of high school. So, you know, the curve at which these guys catch up sometimes is different. You know, it's their own clock. And who's to say when they mature? You know, we hope that everybody, you know, gets it right the earlier the better. But, you know, that's, you know, it's kind of on a bell curve.
We're going to talk a little bit about some of the Tin Caps guys, but we've got to talk about Jake Holton and the week that he had opposite you guys this past week. 5 home runs, 6 games, and I think he hit all varieties. Curveball low, slider high, fastball the opposite way. I mean, a guy gets hot like that. I mean, have you seen something like that at this level where a guy gets that hot and displays that kind of power in such a short period of time?
Well, I mean, I haven't seen it in a while, but at this level anyway. But, you know, he was on fire. You know, he had a good week. I think we kind of helped him out a little bit by, you know, recognizing that, you know, he was the hitter that we couldn't let beat us, and we fell behind a bunch. And then when we tried to get back into the count, he made his pay. I believe he hit not one but 2 3-0 homers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a 3-run homer. I think it was game 1, I want to say.
Yep.
I think it was off. Yeah, I believe it was off Berger where he hit a homer 3-0 count.
Yeah, I think that gave them the 3-0 lead, which you ultimately came back from.
Yeah. So, you know, those things are going to happen. Gasser served up a 3-0 home run to him, and then there were some other home runs along the way. So 5 homers, 6 games, tip of the cap to him. You know, I hope he goes off and, you know, we get to see him again, and we'll see what the challenge looks like the next time we face him.
Let's talk about Matthew Acosta, because he came in and filled that roster spot that was vacated when Josh Mears went on to the development list and had an immediate impact. Felt one hit short from the cycle his first game. I'll tell you, I mean, in a lot of ways, he kind of reminds me of a Joey Votto at the plate. You know, he gets a pitch that he likes on the inside. He'll open up and drive it, but he also is a patient hitter that will take it the opposite way.
Yeah, that's a good comp, Joey Votto. I didn't see that from the third base box when I watched him hit, but he definitely is a good hitter. He can do some things. He's got a pretty solid approach. He knows who he is. He knows what he wants to do. you know, I watched him in spring training a little bit, and he played really well. You know, he had a chance to go down to Lake E and get things going. So I was pleasantly surprised to see him come up here and make it an immediate impact. I mean, that's kind of what you want. When guys show up, you hope that they prove the organization that, hey, maybe you didn't send me to the right level to start the season. You know, you can yell and scream as loud as you want. Just don't say a word. You know, just go out there and act like you're from Missouri, the show me state. Get it done.
The injury to Angel Solarte, I know we're not real sure how long he's going to be out, but that put Acosta in the outfield with Rozier and Hassel left to right. Is that what you expect this week, or will Solarte be available to return?
I would believe that Solarte is days away, not too many. We didn't get a chance to see him today, obviously, on the off day, so it'll be a re-eval tomorrow, but he was actually out on the field the other day, and he was kind of moving around a little bit and playing catch, hitting in the cage off a tee. So I wouldn't say he's too far off from returning. So you'll see a blend of, you know, Acosta and Wright, Acosta at first base, and we'll kind of get creative with some opportunities that we've had on a bench to see what guys are capable of doing, you know. Mix it up a little bit, and, you know, Ilarraza might get some starts out there in right field or left field, and we'll see how we go.
You mentioned the 3-0 home run to Holton, and of course Robert Gasser gave up one of those this week, but it was the only mistake he made the entire game, and he's had some ups and downs. He's been challenged a couple of his starts, but he's also shown why the Padres are high on him, and a lot is expected. Thought he had a really solid outing on Saturday. What did you see out of Gasser, and what do you see out of him that's the difference between the real effective Gasser and maybe one that can struggle or be challenged a bit?
Yeah, I would just say it's the fastball command. He is able to command that fastball. He can make easy work of a lineup. You know, he'll run himself into some deep counts. Like I said, he made one mistake on the surface in the box score that day by giving up that homer, but overall, the way that I felt like he pitched, he probably could have pitched himself way into like the seventh or eighth inning had his fastball command been a little bit better. I believe he had three or four walks that outing. I didn't believe it was three. And, you know, you just want to see him sharpen that up a little bit and then move on to the next level. But once he tightens up the ability to throw that fastball in the strike zone, whatever he wants at will, I think you're going to see a guy that really takes off.
One thing that impressed me was that he was struggling, and I believe this was Gasser's performance on Saturday. I'm trying to make sure I got the right guy. But early on, it seemed like there wasn't command of anything. They were struggling with the fastball, struggling finding the feel on that breaking ball. And there was a point where the catcher went out and had a conference at the mound. Jimmy Jones stayed in the dugout, and I thought this might be one of those kind of teaching moments where you're leaving him out there to say, find it yourself. This is where you grow up and you become a pro. I mean, this is, you know, you got to figure it out sometimes on your own. I thought it was an interesting moment, but I was also very impressed because from that point on, he was really, really good.
Yeah, there's no doubt. there's always moments for development and opportunities for guys to learn and grow on their own, you know. When they recognize those moments and they're able to self-align and get back in track, you know, that's ultimately what we want. You know, these guys are going to move levels. They're going to have an experience, different pitching coaches year to year, season to season. So for them to be able to recognize what's in front of them and then, you know, make their own adjustment before it's too late, that's when we start to know that, you know, the fruits and the plants are all starting to grow that we're watering for these guys. So self-alignment, self-taught, make your own adjustments, learn some things. And then there's obviously opportunities, you know, where the learning moments for a pitching coach to come out there or the manager to go out there and have a few words to kind of realign it. So I was impressed with that. He competed his butt off with what he had. He found a way to get it done. And the best thing about it is, you know, when we do like a review with him the next day, he himself was able to recognize his outing, his shortcomings, and then how he was able to put some things back in place. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little bit too late, but he recognized what was in front of him and how he was able to make that adjustment to get back in there. So that's what we're doing here. You know, we're trying to get these players as good as we can to be able to help coach themselves and get on the right track when they need to.
You've got a lot of arms down in the bullpen. It's a roster that has 17 pitchers listed on it. Are there going to be any spot starts? Is the rotation going to be in flex at all, or are you going to stick pretty much with the way we've seen it so far?
Well, as of right now, I believe we're going to continue to roll out this five-man rotation that we did this week. you know, and then along the way, there's always some things where, you know, a guy might miss a start to get him some rest, or a guy might piggyback somebody, or you know, with that five-man rotation, a guy that pitches on Tuesday, then again on Sunday. So, you know, if a guy gets extended a little bit on, you know, that Tuesday, you know, you're kind of mindful that, you know, at these young ages or whatever, you know, maybe on the Sunday start, maybe he doesn't go as deep into the game as you would like him to, you know, regardless of where he is in terms of cruising in the game or whatever. So, but I believe we're going to stick with this five-man and, you know, continue to roll out the arms as necessary out of the bullpen.
Good luck this week at the ballpark. Another six at home, Quad Cities this time. Have a great week, Coach. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
I appreciate you. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep, that is Brian Esposito joining us here on the Masters Heating and Cooling Hotline. We'll take a quick time out. When we come back on the other side, we've got Kevin Bowen, who will join us to talk all things Indy, including the Colts, the 500, and more. That comes up next here on the Sports Rush on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. 462-468-62, the Parkview Sports Medicine text line. Questions, comments, or suggestions, you can always connect with us. Right now, we jump back on the Masters Heating and Cooling Hotline. And joining us from 107.5 The Fan down in Indianapolis, morning show co-host Kevin Bowen. How are you doing this afternoon, Kevin?
Doing great. How are you guys doing?
Doing well, trying to keep up with everything that's happening because it's really coming at us right now, including the Indy 500 qualifying. And, you know, there's storylines here at the top and at the bottom. I mean, it depends on how you want to look at it. Do you want to focus on this high speed, the 234 from Scott Dixon, or do you want to look at some of the guys sitting down there in rows 9 and 10? They're going to have a long day trying to weave through traffic. What did you take away from qualifying now that the dust has settled?
Yeah, I would probably just say in general the dominance of Chip Ganassi and his entire team. I mean, obviously the Dixon 240 number, I think, historically kind of speaks for itself. But, you know, you look at five of their cars in the top 12, all five of them, four in the top six. I think today they topped the speed chart again. It's just, it's pretty crazy to me. You know, yesterday when you got to the final six, it was four Ganassi, two Ed Carpenter cars, and you know, there's one Roger Penske car in the top 12, and that's Will Power in the middle of row four. There's one Andretti car in the top 12, and that's probably not the guy you would have expected in a rookie in Romain Grosjean. So, the fact that you only had two total Andretti and Penske cars, you know, if we had this conversation this time last week, you probably could have won a lot of money thinking that. So I would just say that separation. You know, who knows what's going to happen on Sunday? You know, race trim and qual trim, two totally different things, but I would say just the fact that Ganassi has been so dominant really now throughout the entire month of May, and we'll see how it translates to Carb Day and then Sunday.
Is this Scott Dixon's race to win?
Yes, but you know, I probably would have said the same thing this time last year when he was on the pole. I think Alex Palou next to him, I think, has some very similar Scott Dixon type temperament, and you know, I don't know how different they'll handle those two strategies. But they are teammates, you know, do they try and kind of mix and match strategies, or do they do it, you know, with maybe Jimmy Johnson or Tony Kanaan or Marcus Ericsson, some other guys? I think that'll be an interesting storyline to watch. But, you know, the wild thing about it, Brett, and you know this full well, I mean, Dixon, I think, is a clear favorite, but you look at Vegas, I mean, he's like 7.5 to 1, you know, being a clear favorite in a field of 33 is still really difficult to, you know, get to, you know, 3 to 1 or 4 to 1 odds. So, if you said give me Dixon or give me the field, I'd probably take the field. But just the fact that you could even say that and pause for a second, I think shows you how, you know, consistently all month he's been, and then you just feel like he's due for another win at the Speedway.
What are you looking at this week? I mean, are you looking, like, to me, one of the things to watch for is Takuma Sato. Where did the speed go? Can he have it back for race day? And then the other question, I think, is going to be, how far back can guys move up? Can you get a Elio to come from row 9? Can he get through the traffic and contend in this race? How far back do you consider guys still being in contention? I mean, I think those are a couple of things to kind of keep an eye on this week.
No, I think that's really well put. To me, it's how far back it is too far back. I mean, Elio is starting, 27th, 29th, something like that. You have one row where Colton Herta is back there. Alexander Rossi and Graham Rahal are in row 7 as well. You know, you always see it year in and year out, a guy kind of pluck his way through the field. And obviously strategy and hit sequence and getting the right yellows can help you out there as well. But I just think
seen those guys kind of matriculate their way through the field. Do we see it? You know, Rossi stuck in the middle of a row. Joseph Newgarden is in row five, kind of in the middle as well. I always love watching, and I think being there at the race, it makes it a little bit easier when you can kind of control your own eyes. That's one of my favorite things about the early kind of 50 laps is do you see, you know, especially on the start and then any restarts, how big a jump. Certainly Rossi has done it in his history there. So I think that's kind of a fun storyline to watch.
Let's talk about the big news coming out of Colts camp, because they have signed, according to reports, Nick Foles as a backup quarterback. And I don't think this is a huge surprise. We talked about the matchup of Foles rejoining forces with Frank Reich. We've talked about it for, two or three months now. But I also think it tells us something. I think it tells us that the Colts believe now is their time, that they've got the pieces in place to compete at a very high level, and they don't want to risk an injury to Matt Ryan costing them the season.
Yeah, I would agree, Brett. You know, I tweeted out earlier today, this is another win now move. And, you know, some people kind of push back and was like, win now? You know what? Look, if everything goes according to plan, Nick Foles won't take a snap this season, at least won't take a meaningful snap. But last year, when you had Carson Wentz, a more injured quarterback, you rolled with three very inexperienced backups throughout the season, two of them having never thrown a pass in the NFL, in Jacob Eason and Sam Ehlinger. This year, with a far more durable quarterback, you've decided to go with, you know, outside of Ryan Fitzpatrick, probably the most experienced backup in the NFL in Foles. And you can point to so many other moves that are a little bit more impactful on the win now meter, but I would agree. And I think it's a couple things. I think part of it is that regime is starting to feel a little bit of pressure. I don't know how much of it is from Jim Irsay per se, but I just think it's natural to have, you know, human instinct pressure. Chris Ballard and Frank Reich know that they have a pretty long leash, and a leash that's not as long in many other spots around the NFL. I mean, hell, the two guys that got fired prior to them at this point in their tenures had put up better win-loss records than, you know, Frank and Chris have. So I just think feeling a little bit of that, you can point to the Ngakoue move, certainly the Matt Ryan move, willing to eat the Carson Wentz contract if it would have come to that. They didn't have to, you know, go there because Washington continues to be one of the more inept franchises in the NFL. But I think that's where a lot of this comes from because Matt Ryan's injury history doesn't call for that. Brett, something kind of popped in my head is like, would they have made a veteran quarterback move at some point in the offseason had Nick Foles never hit the open market? Like if Nick Foles stayed in Chicago and he never hit the open market, you know, would they still have made a veteran quarterback move? Or is this because it's Foles? He has history in the system. He actually has a little bit of history with Chris Ballard from the Kansas City days as well. It's brief, but they were together for about a year. But that's something that kind of popped into my head as well.
As far as skill set, how much does it align with Matt Ryan's skill set? Are they similar quarterbacks? Are they different quarterbacks? Because I think that's always important with a backup, too, that they can come in and you can pretty much stick with a similar system.
Yeah, I would say it's probably one of the more similar starter to backup skill sets the Colts have had in a few years.
Because Ehlinger is a different skill set than Matt Ryan. I mean, a completely different quarterback, and that's the other factor in this, I think.
No, I think it's a really good point that you make there. And obviously just general familiarity with the playbook. You know, as much as Sam Ehlinger is a smart guy and, you know, will now be in year two of the system, it's one thing to be learning on a short week, which, you know, typically is when a backup kind of has to get thrown into duty and have a little bit of a cram session. Nick Foles has done that throughout his career. You know, Ehlinger's never done that. Ehlinger's never really been a backup. He wasn't a backup in college and obviously wasn't asked to do anything of substance last season. So I do think they are similar skill sets, and that is a good point.
Did you have a chance to watch any golf this weekend? See what Justin Thomas did? What'd you think about that?
You know, to me, the fascinating thing about Justin Thomas has always been, and I am a Tiger-obsessed fanatic, would probably be putting it lightly, and I've always been curious, like, Tiger's, you know, attraction, for lack of a better term, with Tiger attraction, probably not the right word to use, but Tiger's had an affinity for Justin Thomas, and Tiger doesn't like a lot of people. Like, you know, why was he drawn towards Thomas? And I think you saw in the back nine and in the playoff, why? He's an incredible talent. He's got all the shots. I mean, when he's on, I don't think there's a better, more talented all-around player than him. So certainly he had to be, you know, kind of the field had to come back to him a bit, and Mito Pereira did that. But at the same time, Justin Thomas, last 13 holes of golf, 6 birdies and no bogeys. I mean, it's hard to find a poor golf shot or even an offline golf shot he hit there down the stretch. So just some big-time golf from him. You know, unlike kind of Rory, unlike Spieth a little bit, you know, you've been waiting for one of those two and Justin Thomas to make that move. And again, the field came back to him, but credit Justin Thomas, who didn't get the right draw. You know, weather hurt him in the first two rounds. He was on the tougher end of the draw going out, I think it was afternoon Thursday, morning Friday. But despite that, he was able to overcome it, put himself into a position, play a great back nine, and then you saw how the major pressure impacted some others.
KB, I don't know if we had a chance to talk to you about the Pacers at number 6, but let's say when it comes time the night of the NBA draft and the commissioner steps up to the microphone and says, with the 6th pick of the 2022 NBA draft, the blank, will it be the Indiana Pacers? Will that be the next two words out of his mouth?
Ooh, are you hinting at a potential trade there?
Up or down? Do they stick at 6 or do they up or down from number? Kevin Pritchard has indicated he'll do whatever it takes, right? I mean, isn't that the vibe we're getting? And that makes me think he's not going to be real patient sitting on 6. He's going to want to juggle and move. I don't know. I just have this hunch that if he can find a player to trade with, he might get out of number 6. And I'm not sure if that means up or down, but how confident are you that 6 is going to be that final number?
No, I think it's a great point that you make. You know, listening to Kevin Pritchard last Tuesday, I mean, he harped on an aggressive nature to this draft. He harped on flexibility. And by that, the Pacers are in a position that I don't think all the teams in the top 10 can say they are in the sense of they're in a good cap space spot. They're like $20, $25 million under the cap. They can trade some of their veterans. I mean, Malcolm Brogdon, Miles Turner, you know, both of those guys have been on the trade block and would attract, I think, some level of interest. And the Pacers also have that additional first-round pick next year from Cleveland, at least that's what you hope. And then they have an early second rounder this year. They have the first pick in the second round. So I do think they will entertain a whole lot. And that's what Kevin has done. I mean, Kevin's MO in running this team has been, you know, kind of outside-the-box thinking, maybe not the most traditional acquisitions, but he's executed some great trades throughout that time. So, I still think probably better than 50-50 that they spend that pick, but I don't think it's just normal, like, GM cliche. We're open for business. Like, sure, everybody can say that, but the Pacers have, you know, some assets where they can be a little bit more wheeling and dealing than some other teams in that range.
I really got a feeling that they're going to find whoever is the guy they want, and they're going to figure out a way to get it done. And they're not going to look at who's available at 6. They're going to say, who do we like, and let's go get them.
Yeah, and the only question would be just, can you find the willing trade partner?
Yep, that's going to be the big question.
That's the issue, because the teams above you, you know, how much are they in a win-now mode? Probably not. You know, maybe Sacramento, but I don't think a lot of those teams above you are in that mode. But at the same time, you know, a guy like Shaedon Sharpe, a guy like Ben Mathurin, you know, they're both very intriguing. We'll see where Jaden Ivey goes as well. I just think, and we've kind of hit on this, Brett, I think it's so paramount for the franchise to swing for the fences here.
Yep.
You haven't been in this position before. You've got to acknowledge you're in a small market. You've got to take the biggest swing possible and see if you can get a star.
KB, always appreciate you. We're up against the clock. Got to let you go. Have a great week and enjoy the race.
You bet. See you guys.
Kevin Bowen joining us on the Masters Heating and Cooling Hotline. We'll come back. It's the Sports Rush on 1380 The Fan and 100.9 FM. Back on the Sports Rush, your daily local sports fix, 4 to 6. Brett Rump with Caleb Hatch. Big week this week. What drivers are we going to be talking to this week? I know we've got a list that we're going to have available to us.
Yes, so tomorrow it'll be Callum Ilott. Wednesday, it'll be Rinus VK.
Oh.
Thursday, Connor Daly. And then we have an extra one we can throw in on Friday as well.
Well, Friday, you're going to be down at Indianapolis. Special show.
Yeah, so Kyle Kirkwood we'd have available for Friday as well.
Just got this breaking news that came in, according to Twitter, And let me see, because my Twitter doesn't want to load very fast, but ESPN is reporting that Haskins, when he got hit, that Haskins was legally drunk on the highway down in Florida when he was hit and killed down in South Florida. So that just came through. 46862, it was like 6:30 in the morning. 46862, Parkview Sports Medicine text line. Appreciate you joining us this week. Of course, Caleb at Indianapolis on Friday. Carb Day, 3 to 4, special edition of New Track Record with Caleb Hatch and Justin Kenny live right here on Friday leading into the Sports Rush Friday at 4. That'll do it for us. Thanks to our guests that appeared on the show, Brendan King and Kevin Bowen from 107.5 The Fan down in Indianapolis. Also, TinCast manager Brian Esposito. Have a great night. Enjoy the Stanley Cup playoffs tonight. This has been The Sports Rush.
Podcasts by Federated Media.